Mr. Friedman, please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to go back to Justice Patterson's question, concern, but I would point out that the arbitrator's determination that the school was closed was not challenged at any level and certainly was reasonable and debatable in the circumstances. In any event, Justice Patterson, you asked about defending the arbitrator's award based upon his rationale. I think Mr. Oxfeld alluded to it. I don't know if he exactly said it, but the paintball case is clear. It's the result of the award, not the reasoning that got us there, which has to be reviewed, has to be good or bad. And the result of that award is custodians who had to go in and work during COVID in dangerous times got extra pay. Did that violate public policy or the law? And I would submit to you that it did not. Alternatively, if you look at the arbitrator's award based upon where he says, could they negotiate for more? Could they get paid more? Based on state supervisors, as I talked about before, the statute did not preempt the right to negotiate for more compensation. We talked also about the standard reasonable debatable. What does that mean in this context? It means that the arbitrator's award will be upheld or sustained, that's not the right word, will be confirmed if it's reasonably debatable. And that's true not just on the facts, it's true on the law, it's true on public policy. And in order to go too far from that standard, not be entitled to affirmance, there has to be a direct conflict. And certainly there's no conflict with this law, certainly based on the discussion of what this statute means or doesn't mean. I'd also point out that I don't know that the law technically says this, but considering the issue is it reasonably debatable, an experienced labor arbitrator makes a decision that this is what this contract means and this is what the statute means. And the trial court says, Chancery Division Judge, not only does the statute mean this, I'm sorry, not only was it reasonably debatable, but this is what it was correct and wholeheartedly endorses what the arbitrator did, goes to the appellate division and two judges view it differently. That almost is the essence of reasonable debatable. If you have four reasonable legal minds discussing something, and two feel it means this, two feel it means the other thing, that certainly sounds like something that is reasonably debatable, at least if they're reasonable people.
There's no authority for counting judges in that regard, is there really?
No, there's no authority for that. But just as a matter of common sense, I think if you get a split two versus two, three versus three, that suggests that maybe this is a reasonably debatable decision. But
if if there were three judges on the appellate division, your adversary said, "Well, I'm counting 3-2; the majority wins." So, you'd be objecting.
It's not binding, and we talk about the appellate division. The cases talk about the appellate division looking at the de novo. Well, that doesn't mean all that much because the standard is still reasonably debatable, and it's a high threshold. So whether they review it de novo or don't do it de novo or give some deference to the Chancery Division, there's still a heavy burden that has to be overcome in order to set the award. To set the award aside. That's even true in this court. It comes back down to whether it's reasonable or debatable.
Counsel, you've limited the class of employees for whom the phrase "and for any time lost" would apply to. Are you also then limiting the class of employees who can negotiate for additional pay?
No,
phrase then wrap around to the beginning of the statute?
No, my argument was not that the statute only applies to certain employees. I do think or thought that if you're going in, the statute doesn't even apply because it's talking about people who don't go into school. But I don't think the statute's limited to teachers or administrators. It would apply to anybody, and it doesn't preclude negotiating additional compensation for anybody.
But so are you or are you not arguing that the phrase "and for any time lost as a result" limits the class of people for whom the phrase "as if the school facilities remained open" is modified?
No, I think what that phrase was saying, if anybody couldn't work because of COVID, they would be protected by the statute and get the minimum that the statute required.
In addition to people that can work during COVID.
Yes.
And that's everybody.
Everybody would be covered by the statute. There's no suggestion in the statute that it's limited to certain people, nor is there any suggestion that anybody couldn't negotiate for extra compensation, although it doesn't make sense for custodians to negotiate for extra compensation, because they would be faced with having to come in perilous circumstances. The likelihood is that teachers would not be coming in those circumstances.
But it does, again, say except that additional compensation benefits and emoluments may be negotiated for additional work performed, thus implying that you could negotiate for additional benefits, but only if there was additional work performed.
That would suggest, yes, you could. But again, under state supervisors in all the cases came after that, there has to be a prohibition. And I would submit that coming in dangerous circumstances where most of the world was staying home would be tantamount to extra work.
In other words, it doesn't say this overrides the existing CNA.
It does not.
In theory, that last clause means the custodians could come back and say, we want even more, and we want to negotiate more, because it says additional compensation benefits and emoluments may be negotiated.
Yes, but I don't think the employer would have to negotiate at that point, because you'd have a contract and they'd have to live by the contract.
Correct.
But if an employer wanted to reopen and negotiate more, they could, but they don't have to.
But it doesn't override, and you've clarified your view on that second language. The CBA, which preceded this statute, as I understand your argument, overrides, the CBA said if the school's open, here's what the compensation is, and if the school's closed, here's what the compensation is. It makes that closed versus open very important to the 2.5 times ratio. And your contention is that public school employees covered by CNA, et cetera, the compensation, shall be entitled to compensation benefits and emoluments as provided in the collective negotiations agreement, as if the school facilities remain open. Now, I could see your argument if there wasn't a provision the school as to what the compensation is if the schools remain open, but there is one. There are two different provisions, one for schools closed, one for open. And this says, not we're overriding your CNA, but we're going to the provision of your CNA that applies when the school is open. That's the one that applies in this unique situation that we're all in.
Except that you could still negotiate for more than what your contract within the statute said. And actually, that's up to that's all good and well. And you may think that, or another judge may think that, or some judges. But it's up to the arbitrator, and the arbitrator made a decision, and that decision was reasonably debatable.
I think everybody agrees that if there is a direct conflict between a statute and a CNA, then the statute prevails. I think we talked about that with Justice Wayne Raptor's, example of the legislature setting wages, for example. But I just want to focus on that because it doesn't purport to override the CNA. It purports, I think, arguably, to direct the school board to the provision of a CNA that applies if the schools are open. See what I'm saying? It's not saying, oh, forget everything's in your CNA.
It's not a simple case, but I think that's an oversimplification, because the reality of the matter is school was closed. The arbitrator found that school was closed. And so therefore you have to apply the situation, interpret the situation as if school were closed. Like the contract said, if school is closed, this is what you get.
So pause
and
there
that
for
was
a
never
second.
Set aside.
Pause there for a second. You have Justice Patterson's not unreasonable question, and you have your not unreasonable observation by the arbitrator.
Well, then that's the answer.
And what happens?
That's the answer. If you have a reasonable question and you have a reasonable answer on the other side, the arbitrator has a reasonable answer. That's what controls. Is it reasonably debatable? And that was sort of the point I was trying to make about the trial court, but the Chancery Division and the arbitrator and the appellate division. You had a couple opinions this way, two opinions that way, which almost demonstrate on their face, unless they're crazy, which nobody was, that they're reasonably debatable.
Other questions, anyone?
I just had one more thing, and it's barely even a point. I just want to give you the site. I think I did, but I'm not sure. To the Robbinsville decision, that's 227 New Jersey 192 at 199, page 199. And that makes very clear when we're talking about the pay. We're really at the heart of the Park Act, we're at the heart of what's negotiable. You know, I won't repeat the terms. The terms are really there. And I think I've covered everything I want to. If there's any questions,
thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Rivera.
Good afternoon, Ramon E. Rivera. May it please the court, I'm here today on behalf of the East Orange Public School District. And based on the earlier arguments, I'm going to just jump right into it. The arbitration decision issued by Arbitrator Tillum resulted in a decision that awarded compensation as if schools were closed, which is directly in contradiction to the law at the time. The statute, albeit recently passed around the time this arbitration was ultimately decided, was in April of 2020. But it's clear that the Tillum Award was not reasonably debatable, as it was contrary to law. And there's numerous cases that support that finding, including Local 195 at 169 NJ 505, where the court vacated an award which was contrary. There are other decisions that support this, but I think it's pretty clear that the appellate division has consistently found that awards that are not reasonably debatable are therefore vacated. And here, what happened with Arbitrator Tillum was that, and this came out earlier, he interpreted the law incorrectly. First of all, he found that the law had no cap on additional pay, which clearly the law as intended at the time was in essence to create a status quo in the midst of a global pandemic that created all kinds of uncertainty. And that status quo was not one-sided. The status quo was both for employees, that you would be paid as if schools were open, all employees, which the language clearly affords, but also for districts, and all of our public school districts would also be ensured that they were not going to pay more than what they budgeted for as if schools were open. So provisions and contracts that called for additional extraordinary pay, like the one at issue here, when there was an emergency, would only create additional stress on these budgets by requiring unanticipated costs. Now, this language had been negotiated years and years prior to primarily deal with inclement weather issues or boiler issues or some local outbreak that might last for a short period of time. But certainly the contract language was not contemplated to cover over a year and a half of being under a state of emergency. In addition, the arbitrator also excluded or didn't understand the exclusion of Section E, which clearly indicated Section E would be construed to permit preemption of any existing collective bargaining agreements. This was the one section within the entire law that allowed for this, just in case there were any provisions where there might be a grievance or something. So what should the arbitrator have done? He should have reviewed the law as we presented to him and also reviewed our arguments. And right there at the decision point, he should have ruled, I do not have the legal authority to issue compensation above what you've been paid already based on the district being open. Instead, he inserted his own unreasonable interpretation, which was that somehow his authority exceeded beyond that of the legislature, where he could not be constrained to laws that might preempt his authority, where we see that routinely over and over again. For example, Chapter 78, which passed in 2011, clearly modified terms and conditions of employment. The State Health Benefit Commission routinely will pass changes in their health plans that then change local plans and what local individuals get. We see this over and over again. Certain times there are instances where the legislature will pass laws that could preempt existing contractual benefits. But here, this was part of a way to say, candidly, hypothetically, you are in an open environment when we all know at the time the schools were physically closed. And the legislation starts there. It starts with, in the event of a closure of schools in school district due to a declared state of emergency, declared public health emergency, or directive by the appropriate health officer, health agency, or officer to institute a public health related closure for a period longer than 3 school days. So once you're past 3 school days, you're operating in a physical closure, but then the remainder of the language kicks in. That language then allows the district to operate as if it's open only for compensation purposes. And what did that mean? That meant that we continued to pay regular salaries for individuals, whether they came to work, they taught remotely, or in some instances, they couldn't come to work or perform their functions because they were a coach of a spring track team. And there were no track meets, but they still received their compensation because we had to treat them and the entire district as if it was open. And those track meets, those games were happening, even though in reality they weren't. And I argue that that's the purpose behind the language that my adversary, Mr. Oxfeld, argued for that begins with and. And for any time loss as a result of school closures or the use of virtual or remote instruction. That language just dealt with additional categories of individuals who may not be able to perform because of the closure. That did not apply to custodians. Custodians, like every other group, maintenance, security, any other folks that weren't involved in instruction, were still covered by the beginning provision that talked about public school employees. Continuing on, as argued in our brief, we address the issue of reasonably debatable. And I argue that the...
Before you turn to that, can I ask you, sure, what's your interpretation of the language, except that additional compensation benefits and emoluments may be negotiated for additional work performed?
So I'll give you an example that may illustrate it. We may have a custodian or maintenance employee who has a regular schedule. They may also serve as a lunch aide. They may serve as a coach after school. They may serve an additional service. If we need them to perform anything else, like handing out school lunches, which was a big thing that we did, they could negotiate additional compensation for that extra work performed.
So it doesn't override or in any way change the CNA, that clause. It just says for extra responsibilities, you can negotiate extra pay. Is that fair?
Absolutely, because the preceding paragraph limited us, the district, to only pay as if we were open.
So let's go back to that argument. We have a CNA that says if schools are closed for an emergency, custodians who work are entitled to 1.5 times pay in addition to their regular pay under the CNA. Turn to the statute again and tell us what language clearly and expressly overrides that negotiated right.
The language that reads as follows. And I'm just going to say, as provided in the collective negotiations, as if schools remained open.
So that doesn't say, and the legislature could have said, we mean to override collectively negotiated agreements in the course through that statement. It doesn't actually use plain language to that effect, does it?
But I respectfully disagree, Justice. In the beginning sentence, it reads, nothing in subsection B, C, or D of this section shall be construed to limit, supersede, or preempt rights, privileges, compensation, remedies, and procedures afforded to public school employees. However, E is not listed. The legislature could have easily just listed E or made no mention at all, and then there may have been an argument there, but the fact that it was specifically excluded means that it would clearly override, preempt, supersede any collective bargaining agreement.
So by leaving out words, it has somehow clearly overridden a collectively negotiated agreement?
I think you read it in the context also of the beginning section, which talks about all public school employees, and then goes on further, as I stated earlier, that we are to pay them as if the district was open. And this was a provision that only applied if the district was closed. So it was directly on point to this specific issue that required us legally, in order to comply with the statute, to treat these employees as if the district was open.
And it takes you back to the provision of the CBA, does it not, that for when the schools are open?
Correct.
It doesn't cancel out the enforcement of the CBA, but it directs the school board to go to the provision of the CBA that that applies when the schools are open, as opposed to the ones that would apply in other circumstances when the schools are closed.
I agree. And it would also have created additional potential chaos around compensation if we would have been able to pick and choose on where we're going to determine what's open or what's closed. So we treated all situations as if we're open, even where, as I mentioned earlier, someone may not have actually performed a task. We would have had to go back in and say, well, does that change how we treat your instruction? Does that change how we deal with coaches? No, it was simple and easy for districts to just treat it as they did the prior year.
Can you explain that a bit more? I that was your interpretation of the words for any time loss as a result of school closures or use of virtual or remote instruction, right? So does that mean were there coaches who were paid by the track meet or by the game or something like that? And so the meaning of this was, even though there are no track meets and there are no games, you still have to pay the coach for the number of track meets or games that there were last year?
Well, there certainly may have been per diem individuals who were paid for specific work performed on an isolated basis, but typically coaches are paid by a semester or, you know, for a period of time. And I do recall at the time there were questions about, do we still have to pay these coaches? We're no longer having any games. And based upon the law that we were to treat them as if it was open, we paid all of them. And so to answer your questions, no, not all of them. Some of them were paid in addition to their regular pay by a stipend of a few thousand dollars, and that came in, was rolled into your pay. Because this action wasn't performed, the issue was, well, what do you do with it? Well, this talks about time lost as a result of school closures, which I believe was directly on point for that issue.
Help me understand this, because I think you have a reasonable argument when you say pay as if schools are opened means even if they're closed, you're still going to get paid. And that's, let's call that argument one.
Yep.
And argument two is, we have a CNA that says what to do when schools are closed. These schools were in fact closed, as the arbitrator found. Nowhere does it say, and we're setting aside CNAs. It's just not in the language there. Why aren't they both reasonable arguments? In which case, the reasonably debatable standard would control and decide the outcome here.
I think you could make that argument as you applied to the arbitrator's decision if he would have made that argument. But he does not make that argument.
Didn't he say these schools were closed?
He made it
closed.
His issue was the definition of the word closed, which he likened to going to Costco and being closed. He did not address the issue at all of what you just articulated, that the legislature should have specifically referenced school closure in this statute. His only comment in the one paragraph, one sentence, was that he questions the legal authority for his ability to issue an award to be preempted by the legislature. He didn't bring that up, and I think it's critical if we're going to look at whether it was reasonably debatable as to what his analysis is, not what may have come up through legal argument by counsel, but he never brought that up. So when we were looking to seek to vacate or modify the award, that was not at issue.
Don't you also just go back to the first sentence, which we never read the end of it, which is nothing in subsection B, C, or D of this section shall be construed to supersede or preempt any provision of a collective bargaining agreement entered into by the school district, i.e., any provision of a collective bargaining agreement entered into by the school district is preempted or superseded by subsection E where there is a conflict.
I agree. I believe it's abundantly clear by the following sentences, which clearly may have an impact on language in a collective bargaining agreement.
Ordinarily, we review orders and judgments, not the decisions underlying the issuance of the order or the judgment. In the context of an arbitration involving a public sector dispute, would it be true that we review the arbitrator's award, meaning the issuance of a dollar amount, just like we would have reviewed an order or a judgment, rather than the decision, and in this case, the arbitrator's reasoning?
Well, respectfully, I disagree. You'd have to look at the reasoning that the arbitrator used to justify the decision, because the decision may just simply a dollar amount. In the abstract, reviewing whether that amount is reasonable doesn't provide context for you to form an opinion under the case law as to whether it's reasonably debatable. And we come back to, you know, the case law that repeatedly over and over, an arbitration decision that's contrary to law is equal to unreasonable and not debatable, right? That's where we are. This arbitration award is contrary to law because he concluded three things. One, there was no cap in this. There clearly is a limitation in cap on the plain reading of it. You're only going to get what you would get if the district was open. No more, no less. So that was unreasonable. Number two, he concluded that he didn't believe or he wasn't sure if he could be preempted by the legislature. That's clearly incorrect under the law. He absolutely can, as well as any other entity. The legislature puts out laws and it may impact your agreement or your ability to work. Those are two issues where he was absolutely wrong.
Where is the language that you have argued twice? You're only going to get, where is that found in the statute?
So I go back to the sentence regard which and well has open in it, which clearly states that public school employees covered by a collective negotiations agreement shall be entitled to compensation, benefits, and emoluments as provided in the CNA as if school facilities remain open.
So pause for a second there, as you did. That means you're going to get paid.
Yes.
Where does that say you're only going to get paid that?
Then we continue. I'm just going to read it all. For any purpose and for any time lost as a result of school closures and use of virtual instruction, nothing there, comma, except that additional compensation, directly in response to your question, additional compensation, benefits, and emoluments may be negotiated for only one thing, additional work performed.
So if a custodian under that provision were tasked with, I'm going to make this up, you can tell me if it's a bad example, repainting the entire school or tarring the furnace, and something that's not ordinarily encompassed in the custodian's responsibilities. The plain language says you can negotiate for more money for that additional work.
Sure. In the future.
This is different, though. This is a custodian performing the same work he'd been performing weeks before COVID-19 hit and schools were closed. No?
Yeah.
But so this language, as you read it, clearly covers anything that the custodian is doing. They can negotiate, but all bets are off with regard to the contract that they had before. You read that into the language here.
Correct. I read it as this entire paragraph impacts the paragraph in the contract that talks about 2.5 times for periods when the school is closed. I'm just going to paraphrase it.
So to go one step further, the arbitrator says, if we're going to look at this language, this isn't clear to me. The arbitrator reads this language and comes away determining in his judgment that this is not the clearest of statutes. I'll ask you, do you think it is the clearest of statutes?
Well, I only have one answer. Yes, absolutely, 100%, because it speaks about treating the school district as if it's open. It's one paragraph. I know we're talking about numbers of
and any other interpretation is completely wrong.
I would argue, yes, any other interpretation is unreasonable.
Just to be clear about your position, you're not taking the position that all bets are off under the CNA, are you? But under the statute?
With respect to what issue?
You're not throwing out the CNA. Your position is that it sends you to a different provision of the CNA.
Correct. The CNA is not invalidated.
No.
One specific provision of the CNA doesn't apply during the period of time when we're closed for more than 3 days due to a public health emergency issued by the state. That's it. That one provision that may be in ours, that may be in 566 other school districts that have that similar provision.
Well,
but that doesn't apply because the legislature said so.
I was going to ask you, has this come up as far as you know in other districts? Because it seems to me that if the CNA is similar in other places, that you'd expect there to be a dispute. I don't know.
There were other districts that dealt with the issue. We're only representing this one in this context, but I did not find it to be widespread. There were particular contracts that had language like this that we all understood colloquially to just address inclement weather issues.
When you begin your argument, you mentioned the legislature changing health plans and therefore changing language in existing CNAs. Does the legislature ordinarily do that?
So the legislature, when Chapter 78 was passed in 2011, required compliance over a phased-in period of time.
What language does it use that makes clear what is happening? Can you cite?
I apologize, Ron. I don't have that language in front of me. I just have an understanding of what the law required.
Is it more specific, about as specific, less specific than the language?
I think it's equally as specific as this language, but that's not a fair comparison. This is, in my opinion, a very simple provision contained within this section of the law compared to Chapter 78. Or with the context of the Shearing case, which dealt with the SEPA claim and the invalidation, that was a very complex law. So was Chapter 78. There were numerous iterations before. There were other amendments in 2007 to address. And I think that the language may be different. I think on its face, this has to be looked at in somewhat of an isolation, that this one paragraph represents a very simple, straightforward way to deal with compensation during this period of time. And if you just were to turn to a different section, section 3 of this, it's a similar approach that was addressed at contracts with districts. For example, bus transportation companies. Same idea, we're gonna treat the district as it's open, and we're gonna pay for your bus contract, even though you are not providing any service to us. It precluded the districts from refusing to pay and prevented districts from going after and collecting any funds that it may have paid when you didn't receive the service.
Sorry, can you tell me exactly what you're citing? That's
I'm looking at paragraph 3 in the law under E1, 2, and 3.
You mean C? Oh, no, E1, 2.
Am I off? Okay. I think it's E1, 2, 3.
Okay.
Apologize. If school or school district is subject to a health-related closure for a period of longer than 3 consecutive days, when the result of the declared state of emergency, blah, 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 I'm sorry, then the district shall continue to make payments and benefits, compensations, and amendments pursuant to the terms of a contract with a contract service provider in effect on the date of the closure, as if services for such benefits, compensation, and amendments had been provided as if the school facilities had remained open. The same idea, the same language. Disruption of section 1 will impact all of these sections and could potentially have a major effect on funds that have been exchanged during this period of time. And why I bring it up is just that there's a consistent theme here, which lends itself to an understanding of this law, that this was to address and treat the district from an employment standpoint, from a business standpoint of paying our contracts, as if the school district was open. And
is this language that you quoted for us from paragraph 3, in section 3, a floor and a ceiling, or just a floor?
You're still floor going and a ceiling.
And a ceiling.
You received your, provided $100,000 for bus routes.
Right.
You received the full $100,000.
Right, but there's no additional, and this is my question, is there an additional provision that says, and you'll get time and a half for whatever purpose as a bus provider?
In other words, is there a corollary contract provision that would be similar to the CNA provisions that we're dealing with under subsection E?
There certainly are in the beginning. With respect to the second part of the question, if the bus company were to provide additional work or something else, would they be entitled to additional compensation?
No, is there a contract provision for bus drivers that says, in the case of a school closing or an emergency, you would get time and a half if you're working like we're dealing with here?
Oh, no, I'm not aware of a specific provision here that talks about the employment contract for a bus contractor. My point in bringing this up is that the district was legally obligated to continue to make payments to service providers, whether it's a bus entity, whether it's a special ed company that's providing services to kids, any service they were required to continue to make those payments despite not receiving those services.
That's the floor. That's the promise that had been made. You're now arguing in section E1 that very language is not only a floor but a ceiling as well.
Yes, because E1 had the section at the end that provided any additional compensation would have to be for additional work performed.
I have a question about that, because I think the argument by your colleagues over here was that additional compensation benefits and emoluments may be negotiated for additional work performed reverts back to the longstanding CNA. Is that the correct interpretation of the contract, or is it about, look, if you're going to have the custodians do a renovation that's needed or do some extra work that's required to bring the schools back up, or whatever it may be, additional work going forward, there's a negotiation and additional compensation. So do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I agree with it because they talk about may be negotiated. So it was for work that was not yet performed. That would be outside of your...
I was just wondering, the language suggests a time element to that. Not they know how to say, certainly the legislature knows how to say, if you've negotiated it, it stays in place or something along those lines. There are 100 ways that could have said that. But this seems to be sort of going forward issues in terms of the way it's drafted.
And that's how I read it. That it would be for future work that was not that was additional work performed could be negotiated to require additional compensation.
Did the appellate division's opinion overlook the reasonably debatable standard altogether?
No, and I certainly spent a lot of time reviewing my adversary's brief, and that was repeatedly stated. I believe on page 21 of the appellate division's decision, they address specifically the issue of the reasonably debatable standard. And my recollection from the review of that decision was that they quickly dispatched that it was not reasonable because it was in direct contravention of the law, which I previously argued here, and was in direct conflict based upon the determination that they were entitled to compensation because the district was in fact closed.
That's also on pages 15 and 16 of the appellate division's decision, where they set forth the standard of review, and they say correctly, in the public sector, an arbitrator's award will be confirmed so long as the award is reasonably debatable. And then they also go through the statutory grounds for vacatur under 2A:24-A all the way to D, correct?
Correct.
That's not an application. The application is page 21, right? That's the background description of the
right. I believe on page 21, if I'm correct, it clearly makes a determination on the appellate division addresses the reasonably debatable standard and finds that the arbitrator's decision was not reasonably debatable because, and primarily, it was in direct contravention of the law.
It specifically says the arbitrator's interpretation of the statute as permitting custodial employees to receive extra compensation because the school facilities were closed to students is not reasonably debatable. Correct?
Correct.
And then it also goes into how it's directly contrary to the statute and it cannot possibly be harmonized, et cetera.
And I think just to bolster that, in the Weiss v. Carpenter-Bennett case, 143 NJ 420, quote, arbitrators cannot be permitted to authorize litigants to violate either the law or those public policy principles that government has established by statute, regulation, or otherwise for the protection of the public. I think that's what underscores the appellate division's decision here, is that by affirming this, or I'll put it in the inverse, by invalidating it, they are protecting the statutes as passed by our legislature, which are clear, reasonable, and easy to understand.
So, factual question I wanted to follow up on. right now, what is the status of the pay? Has the, I understand there was a motion for stay of the appellate division decision filed. That motion was denied. Has pay been returned via the appellate division decision? No.
Justice, so I'm just going to go backwards and give you the full context. Yeah. We were under court order by Judge Alpert to make a payment, which we did. And so I believe there's about 1.5, 1.75 million that has been paid. And that money we have not sought to recoup or taken any action to recoup from the individuals who received it. And so if my numbers are off, I apologize, we'll correct it, but we have made a significant payment to a group of employees under court order.
Sorry, I want to make sure I understood. I thought that that you were seeking to recoup it. You're not seeking to recoup the money.
No, I didn't say we weren't. I said we have not.
Oh, understood.
I'm not conceding any issue there, but we have not at this point taken any action to garnish or to recover because of the pending legal matters that are before us. So that money is there. There is an additional potential, depending on where this goes, for additional payment to be required under this order, just because there's dispute as to whether everyone that should have gotten their payment received their payment. And then the final piece after this, the parties did meet and negotiate provisions in the contract that changed this language completely. So this is not something that, based on language, and hopefully nothing unforeseen happens, that may happen again. So it's kind of a finite issue that we're dealing with, hopefully.
In other words, there's a new CBA provision that deals with how you're...
Correct. We separated weather and public health.
Sorry?
We separated out weather, inclement weather issues and public health emergencies or other things.
Two different provisions apply to those two contingencies.
Yes. Sorry, but you're saying you are seeking to recover the 1.5 to 1.7 million that was already paid.
Correct.
Why did the board, for the first 4 months, pay the 2.5 times to custodians, maintenance, and security?
I don't know specifically why. Just as an assumption, they may have just been paying everyone as they paid in the past related to inclement weather and other short-term closures. And in my line of work representing numerous public entities and school districts, there are instances where payments may be made that are not necessarily consistent with the contractual obligations.
Well, they would have had to pay it before the statute was passed anyway, right?
Yeah, between March 13th, is COVID beginning from my recollection, to April 20th would have been prior to the legislation, and then the legislation comes out, and digesting it, understanding, you know, the impact does take a little bit of time. And the final piece, just know that, just because I was involved, we did not know when schools were going to open. It was a week by week determination. So at that time, it was difficult to prepare. No one knew that we were going to be out for till July of 2021 or June. It was on a week by week basis that you were preparing. So
if the statute was crystal clear, did the board violate public policy by making those payments?
No. Because I believe there was a reasonable basis for the board to continue to make the payments. And
after the statute was enacted?
I mean, yeah, given that this was an unprecedented global pandemic and the board had numerous priorities, which included feeding children and...
No, but your position to us today is this statute is clear that those payments are inappropriate. Does that mean that the board acted in a way contrary to public policy?
I believe a requirement that we must make those payments is contrary to law and illegal. But a board making payments beyond what's legally required, I do not believe violates public policy.
It was pretty soon thereafter that you were in litigation over it, I assume.
Yeah,
I'm trying to remember the number of months that went by.
I think you stopped making the payments in July of 2020.
In July, we stopped
right?
making
so
the payments.
Three months after the statute was filed thereafter.
Are you seeking recoupment for the monies paid?
Yes, we will be seeking recoupment. We were. We will. We have not taken any action to garnish.
But specifically from April or from the time of July, the payments that have now been made from July forward or including April as well?
We will determine that, but at this point, we have not taken action to seek recoupment for the payments made from April 20th to July.
And you couldn't based on the arbitration award, because the arbitration award only was that it ordered you to make payments from July of 2020 until July of, was it 2021 or 2022? Because the public health emergency didn't end, or this state of the public health emergency didn't end until July of 2022. So I wasn't sure on what the end date was.
I believe it was July of 21.
Schools physically reopened, right?
I believe they reopened in that the fall of 21.
Correct, but I thought the payments have nothing.
But the public health emergency that the governor declared did extend out, but
until July of 2022.
We were back in classes at that point. So, and just to go back to the question, I agree. The issue, this litigation would prevent us from going back and seeking the compensation from April 20th to July
of 2020.
But if, depending on how this resolves, that issue may then rear its head for us to address in terms of us going back and including that within the recoupment amount.
Sorry, you're saying that 6 years after the fact, even though you were voluntarily paying the money from April until July of 2020, you could go to individual custodians 6 years after the fact and say, actually, we need that money back. There would be no grounds for that under this litigation, correct?
This was not included in the litigation, okay. Correct.
Would you agree there may be some tension between declaring that the statute was clear, that these monies are not to be paid, and you're paying them in the absence of an arbitrator's award saying anything? Is there any tension there? You're saying the CNA should have been set aside, and yet you honored it.
We honored it before, and we were paying it before the legislation was passed, from March 13th through April 20th. Then the legislation is passed.
You continued to pay, and we continued to pay July 13th.
We did, but ultimately, based upon numerous factors, which included reviewing the legislation, decided to stop paying it in July. I don't believe that payment of something undermines your legal ability to have to pay it, right? That doesn't mean that it still invalidates whether the statute was clear, whether the arbitrator's award was reasonably debatable, whether or not we paid it, in the midst of something that quite candidly was unprecedented within our society.
At the legislature enacted a statute that said this overrides contrary provisions in existing CNAs. Payments shall not be made in accordance with them. Would you have paid then?
As of April 20th?
Yeah.
I mean, we certainly would have endeavored to comply with the law as quickly as possible.
But it's normal for you to have to look into the law that was enacted, discuss what it means and how it changes what you've been doing, correct?
Anything else you'd like to add?
No, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Ms. Rajpa.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. The Attorney General joins in the arguments of the Board of Education in that the appellate division here correctly determined that the arbitration award was contrary to the clear and unequivocal language of the statute. And it is well established that arbitration awards should be upheld if they're reasonably debatable. Here, the award was not reasonably debatable. The statute provides that in the event of a school closure due to an extended state of emergency longer than 3 days, and I'm paraphrasing, but that employees covered by the contract shall be entitled to compensation as provided in the agreement as if the schools were open. So that simply means that employees were to be paid however their agreement said that they were to be paid, however the agreement said to pay them when the schools were open. And the language at the end of E1 is also significant in that it does provide that additional pay can be negotiated if the employees in these extended closures are doing additional work. And this provision does make the language even more clear.
Can I interrupt you for a moment on that? I just want to ask the same question I've asked a couple of people about that. And that is, does that mean, is it the Attorney General's interpretation of the statute that last sentence means going forward, there can be additional work, there can be negotiations for the payment for that additional work, but not that you revert back to this, to the provision of the CBA that applies if the schools are closed. Do you see what I'm saying? It's two of possibilities.
Your Honor, I believe the interpretation is that I don't believe that the language necessarily says in the future, but that if these, we believe that it means that if these, let's say, custodial employees were doing additional work, some kind of additional work, that they could be paid for this additional work, that could be negotiated.
So for example, if the collective bargaining agreement said, you know, in a case of emergency, you're paid 2.5 times your regular salary, and in the case that you are asked to repaint the entire school, then you're paid 2.5 times your regular salary. Here, if they were then asked to repaint the entire school, they could be still paid 2.5 times their regular salary because that is what the collective bargaining agreement had provided for additional work.
Correct, Your Honor. And I wanted to point out that in the record here, I don't believe it was ever established that, you know, the custodians who were the subject of this grievance did perform additional work. I believe, in fact, that the record showed that there weren't claims of additional work being performed. So we're just talking about employees who were doing their regular work. So meaning they were doing their regular job duties. So custodians who were going into work, doing whatever their regular job duties were to be paid per their collective negotiations agreement, specifically how their contract said to pay them for regular work. So no more or less. So in that respect, we agree with the Board of Education that the statute sets not just a pay floor, but also does set a pay ceiling. And that language at the end of E1 is indicative of that the legislature has this exception permitting extra compensation when there is, additional work being performed. So the statute's intent here is clear that it does ensure that all public school employees were to continue to be paid during this pandemic, but it also limited the school district's financial exposure. So although arbitration, we agree, is a favored form of dispute resolution in the state, an arbitration award that is directly contrary to the law cannot stand. And this arbitration award is directly contrary to the statute. So therefore, the award was not reasonably debatable and not stand.
When you read the statute, appears like you committed sort of the fatal flaw that your opposing counsel would say in stopping at the word open and not reading for any purpose and for any time lost as a result of school closures or use of virtual or remote instruction. Now, opposing counsel argues that that's a limiting clause, that indicates that the statute can't apply to custodial employees because custodial employees were there every day and there would never be any reason for a statute to reference remote work for them. How do you respond to that?
The statute, Your Honor, does not limit the statute to just virtual employees. The statute does cover all public school employees who have a collective negotiations agreement. So that language, and for any time lost as a result of school closures, or use of virtual or remote instruction. We don't believe that that is limiting language.
If that's the case, then what's the purpose of that language?
So I think that it has to be read with the rest of this subsection of the statute, which is that these public school employees shall be paid as provided in the agreement, as if the schools are open, and for any time lost as a result of school closure, that could be going back to any time that they lost when the schools were previously closed. I don't see that language as changing the overall statute, which is that the employees are to be paid, all the public school employees are to be paid, but they are to be paid exactly how their contracts say that they are to be paid, as if the schools are open and not closed.
So what's the time lost?
Is that because it wasn't otherwise retroactive? When the statute was passed on April 20th, was it retroactive back to March 13th such that there was no time lost? Or was it not retroactive back to March 13th such that this could be referring to the 1 month that had already been lost?
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe that the statute was not retroactive, so this would be referring to the time lost.
Is it a limited retroactivity provision? In other words, saying it's from here on in on April 20th, but we know people have already lost time. Is that how you interpret it?
Yes, Your Honor, because it says as if the school facilities remain open and for any time lost. So that would be for any time that was lost prior to the passing of the statute. But it doesn't, that language does not change the intent of the statute, which is that employees were to be paid as if the schools were open.
So if that language did not exist, how would the statute be different substantively?
I don't know that the statute would be different. I think that the language overall just says the intent is that these all public school employees who are covered by an agreement were to be paid as if the school facilities remained open for any purpose, and then for any time lost would be whatever time they had lost. But then immediately it goes into except that additional compensation may be negotiated for additional work. And that allows anybody like a custodian who had to go in during this time of an extended closure to do additional work beyond their regular work, those individuals could then get additional pay if that was negotiated.
It seems to me that you're saying that it would be different because if that language was not there, it may not capture pay for that month period between March and April in which schools were closed but the amendment had not been enacted yet. Is that so? It seems to me you are saying that that language does serve a purpose, or am I misunderstanding?
I mean, the only purpose that I understand of that language, Your Honor, is that it the and there. So they're being paid as if the schools are open for any purpose and for any time lost as a result of school closures. So to me, that and is going back to the time that the schools were closed prior to the statute, which says that the schools are basically open for purposes of just the statute.
About 2 months. Am I right about the chronology?
I think it was about a month, Your Honor. Yes.
Counselor, your fellow counsel, Mr. Rivera, argued that the legislature's change in healthcare plans is an example we might look to. How did the legislature do that? What language did it use then, if you can tell us?
I don't have that in front of me. Are we referring to the East Rutherford case, or I'm not exactly sure specifically what case counsel is referring to.
Please go ahead.
What's that?
Please continue with your argument.
Our arguments, we just join in the arguments of the Board of Education that, you know, where the Attorney General is not we're not arguing for a different, higher deference or a change in the standard. We agree that the standard is the award must be reasonably debatable. And we believe that the statute here is so clear that the award is directly contrary to that statute.
Quick question. Do you have any idea of the breadth of the impact of this case on other cases?
I don't either, Your Honor, because we don't, represent the school board, so I actually right. don't know.
Anything you'd like to add, counsel?
I have nothing additional, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Did not reserve time for rebuttal, if I recall correctly. Did I? Why don't you?
Again, I promise I'll speak quickly. That comes naturally.
Five minutes on the clock.
Okay. So first of all, in response to, I think, a question from Justice Patterson, you asked Mr. Rivera, what other people got paid under the statute? And he responded two categories, coaches and bus drivers. That's exactly my interpretation. Those were people who could not come to work in person. There were no baseball games. Coaches could not come to work in person. There are no students to drive. Buses couldn't be driven. The statute clearly differentiates between those who had to work remotely and those who had to go to work. And Mr. Rivera's answer supported my position. The two examples he gave you were people who could not go to work. I answered one of Justice Apster's questions incorrectly initially. The contract says when schools were closed by order of the governor, schools had to be closed. So once schools reopened, even though there was still a state of emergency, once they reopened, the obligation to pay ended under the contract language. And I'm
That's
sorry.
That's why it ended in July of 2021, correct. Even though the public health emergency went on until March of 2022.
The statute was passed in April, so April to May to June to July. So it was 3 months that the board continued to pay after the statute was enacted. The Attorney General's position is arrogant and is condescending. The Attorney General is basically saying, I understand that, but the Attorney General of our state.
Counsel, let's argue the legal issues here and leave the attack language in mind.
Well, first of all, throughout the Attorney General's brief, pages 1, 2, 3, and 4, it cites the statute, no and. The exact same problem that the appellate division had when they referred to the statute on pages 1, 2, 3, and 4 of its brief.
But you have never made this precise argument.
So
you keep saying that everyone has gotten this wrong because they're ignoring the most crucial language. Had you argued that these few words that you're arguing before us were the most crucial language before the arbitrator, before the Chancery Court, and before the appellate division?
For the appellate division, that was my main argument, that this did not apply to custodial workers because of that language.
Because of these specific words.
Yes. And I mean, that's why I think it's significant that the appellate division reads the statute, period, end quote, before the word and is there.
No, the statute is not hidden away in a safe somewhere. It's public record. Mm-hmm. Everyone has it. Everyone's read the entirety of it. I don't think we have any situation where a portion of the statute has somehow been kept secret from any of the judges.
I maintain that the dichotomy that is set up by the Attorney General's office is almost a reverse Robin Hood, that we're not going to pay people who have to report to work, who are the poorest paid people in the district, so that we can afford to pay the teachers. Now, I'm not saying teachers are overpaid, but you're talking about people who are making barely a living wage, having to go to work. You're talking about the custodial workers.
I think what Justice Patterson was just arguing is if this was so crystal clear, why didn't you argue it before the Chancery Court?
I'm sorry.
I think what Justice Patterson was saying was if this was so crystal clear, why didn't you argue this before the Chancery Court?
Before the
trial court.
I argued in appellate division.
Right, but why didn't you argue it before the trial court?
I argued it before the arbitrator, and I also argued the preemption doctrine. The arbitrator adopted the preemption doctrine. It doesn't mean I didn't make the argument. He said it's a floor, not a ceiling. That was my argument on the preemption doctrine. And Justice Patterson, that's another issue that's very fascinating to me. Ignoring the paintball case, which is that we only review the award, what happens if the arbitrator came to the right conclusion? But you think for the wrong reasons.
Counsel, you have 2 minutes, and I would suggest you make it.
Counsel, I do have a quick question. Do you disagree with the premise that the language after the "and" for any time lost as a result of school closures could refer to the time between March 13th and the time that the statute was passed in April?
No, I disagree with that. It applies for any time before and after the statute. There's no limitation in the statute suggesting that interpretation whatsoever.
But the school closures started on March 13th, and I'm assuming at that point nobody went to work, including custodial or teachers, at the beginning at least. And then, so
that may be an assumption. I'm not sure it's in the record. I think they went to school.
I am assuming that, but I'm assuming that when they were initially closed and nobody knew what was happening, that on March 13th and the following week, that nobody went to work for at least a couple of days.
Maybe a couple of days.
So doesn't that language cover any loss from resulting from school closures, any time lost, including custodial workers?
Maybe custodial workers for that 3-day period when they lost time.
But then they're in the statute and then they're covered. So then the language, all of the language.
Because after that period of time, the statute still says, and for working remotely. And they were not working remotely.
Or the use of virtual.
Or the use of virtual, either one, working remotely or virtual.
Sorry, did the statute otherwise say that it was retroactive to the date that the public health emergency was first declared?
I don't believe so.
So then otherwise, in theory, for anyone who did not work for a month after the schools were closed, before this legislation was passed, couldn't the language about time lost that Justice Noriega was just reading refer to that month, 1 month period?
So we're talking about 3 days, not a month in East Orange. The custodians went to work virtually nonstop. And that was the Board of Education's decision.
So it
may apply to that, but it doesn't apply to that only. The final point I want to make is under the argument position of the Attorney General and the Board of Education, there's absolutely no distinction between those who are required to report for work and those who do not report for work. And that just defies common sense. And during a period of COVID, when people had to report for work in person, they're going to be treated the same as if they had not reported for work at all. That just is not found in the statute, and it defies common sense.
Thank you, Counselor.
How can you address Chapter 78 if you want to hear what it says?
That would be helpful.
I don't have it in front of me, but from memory, and I think it's pretty good. One thing it did is it said that it doesn't apply to contracts. It wouldn't apply until a contract expired. So if there was a contract in effect, I'm 99% sure it would not affect that. After that, it would be phased in various amounts, but those amounts were mandatory. You couldn't negotiate something else. You'd have to contribute a certain percentage of premium, or I think percentage of salary. And then after a few years, it might go up, then go up. And then it would reach its maximum, after which you can negotiate it down. But that's the way Chapter 78 was structured.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel for the arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement.